Remaker's Mark, Episode 43, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in part two of our discussion of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight, and what is your favorite town on the French Riviera, specifically?
I am fantastic, and I have always loved visiting Golf Juan.
You visiting or pronouncing?
Well, both, obviously.
It sounds like you mashed together the name of my favorite sport and the plane on which the president flies.
That's a good joke. But really, I love going to Golf 1.
Yes. I prefer 18 myself, but to each their own. Oh, Lordy.
Your cultural insensitivity amuses me, Kyle.
As it should. I'm sorry, but not. Jeremy Nielsen, how are you, and what is your favorite town on the French Riviera?
I am, as they say on the French Riviera, bon. And
très bien.
Nice.
And my favorite French Rivieran town is Saint-Tropez.
Saint-Tropez?
Not to be confused with a Pink Floyd song, Saint-Tropez.
Pronounced exactly right.
Perfect in every way.
It's a military stronghold and unassuming fishing village until the beginning of the 20th century. Pushed down on this coast to be liberated during World War II.
Oh, man.
Jerapedia strikes again.
Dragoon.
Yowzers. Lee Hosterton. Hack Lemison, Howard Hannikerson, Lee Fells, how are you tonight? And what is your favorite town on the French Riviera?
I'm doing just great, and I don't know any towns on the French Riviera, but I've been to Canton 3 times, but that's in Normandy.
Nice.
If you told us it was on the French Riviera, I would believe you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's on a coast.
You could have just listed a brand of French toilet paper and be like, sounds exotic.
No, I bet you like going to Menton.
Say again?
Menton.
Quoi?
It is fresh and full of life. All right, moving on. Mark Josting, for the love of God, how are you, and what is your favorite town on the French Riviera?
I'm great, thanks. And I choose the second largest city in France, which is Marseille.
That being Marseille.
Oh, Marseille. Yeah. But actually, I have a good reason. It was a significant Roman city back in that epoch. So, the city of Marcellius was pretty prominent in my studies. And I honor that heritage by choosing Marseille.
Nice. I would love to go there, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds lovely. Me too. My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host once again this fine evening. And I would say, you know, I have a lot from which to pick, but I would say that my favorite town on the French Riviera is Chateaudoufanoufa de Poufanoufa. It's a lovely town that my people came from. And that's really all I have to say about it before getting choked up. So Chateaudoufanoufa de Poufanoufa.
Tell us about your family that came from Chateaudoufanoufa de Poufanoufa.
De Poufanoufa,
oh,
thank
I'm sorry.
You very much.
Did they invent the loofah there?
They were winers. So, Jer, do you have something that you would like to recommend to us?
After this conversation, I have a lot of things to recommend to you. Very good. Yes, I did have something, and I forgot to pull it up. Okay. yes, I do have something. I have recently been catching up on a sci-fi television show called The Expanse.
Oh, nice.
Has anyone seen it?
No, I'm really wanting to, but I haven't seen it yet. It's on sci-fi, right?
It is on sci-fi. That being said, the initial season, and maybe season two, is on Amazon Prime. I believe they are actually on season three currently in the time period where we are in right now.
Nice.
So basically, it is a future sci-fi show. Earth has basically just turned into Coruscant and is one big giant government body center town. Mars is the other sort of big inhabited place.
Habitable.
And then there are a third group of people, which are out on the edges of the solar system, and they are out there mining mainly water, because that has become the resource that everybody needs that isn't around anymore, and other things that they then ship to Mars and to Earth. And they call those people the Belters, because they're in the asteroid belt. And they have generations of people have been out there for so long that their bodies have kind of started to mutate a little bit, and they're like super tall and skinny, and they have very fragile bones because they spend their entire lives in zero gravity and so on. So it's basically this show about these three different groups and this sort of inevitable conflict of power that is happening, all told through the stories of this. A couple different characters in different locations, kind of like Firefly in that it is kind of an adventure story, but it's a much more linear narrative about this conflict. And it's not about, hey, what wacky adventure are we going to get into today? It's a little bit more serious, but has the same kind of feel of these really interesting, lovable characters that you like. Oh, shoot, I can't think of his name. Lee will help me out. Arrested Development, he played the guy pretending to be homeless to learn about an acting role.
Oh,
Tom Jane?
Thomas Jane.
Tom Jane. Yeah. Yeah. Thomas Jane is in it as a hard-boiled detective on this, like, space station, and it's completely anachronistic. He's wearing, like, an old 1930s fedora. And it's just, it doesn't make any sense, but it somehow works. But it's a cool show. It's what Firefly probably could have been or should have been.
That's in a many bold claim. Ways,
but it is. Thank you. but in also in that, it's also, it's its own thing. It's a very unique, setting and story that's going along with it. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. I'm sorry I talked so long about it.
That's all right. I would very much like to watch that. I keep forgetting that it's on Amazon. There's so many good shows to watch. It's a good problem to have.
Therein lies the problem. I was also going to recommend The Man in the High Castle, but we'll save that for another time.
Cool. Nice. Into it. Andy, as our resident social media expert, would you be up for doing a little sharing of what feedback we got from the Facebooks and the Twitters?
Yes.
I just kind of sprung that one on
you. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Prepping me at all. yeah. Do we get any Twitter feedback from anybody?
Don't think so. I think it was all Facebook. Way to go, Twitter.
All to the Facebook, yeah.
Dying media.
yeah, we had some feedback coming to us via the Facebook. Andy Swanson suggested Ryan Gosling as Freddy and Gilbert Gottfried as Laurent Jameson. Ryan Gosling. I'm assuming Andy Swanson recently saw La La Land, and so he had a little bit of Ryan Gosling on the brain. Not really sure what happened with the Gottfried pick, but hey, it would be interesting.
I think what happened there is that if everybody remembers being in high school or college and you're filling out your exam multiple choice and you realize that you've got like 2 minutes left and 10 answers, so you just start filling out bubbles.
Gotcha.
I think that's what happened there at the end.
All right, well, that makes more sense. And then Paul Tejan, who is a good friend of all of us here on the podcast, and whom I, you know, we're all affectionate towards and care deeply for his welfare, seemed to maybe have had a stroke when he submitted his feedback, because he started out on a good foot. He suggested Leslie Mann and the role of Janet Colgate.
Great pick.
But then kind of lost control of his bodily functions and suggested Dane Cook and the Freddie Benson role. And Brad Pitt.
Maybe he's hoping for like a career reinvention a la Pulp Fiction and John Travolta or something along those lines. You know, that's all I can think of, man. I don't know.
I'm just going to blame some lack of blood flow to his cerebrum.
I know he's been sick.
So maybe he had a lot of cold medicine running through his system. We'll give him a pass on this one.
Fever dream.
Yep. We'll call it a fever dream.
Yeah, Paul, I recommend checking the batteries on your carbon monoxide detector ASAP.
Don't ignore it, Paul. Don't ignore it.
The beeping isn't natural.
Really taking tight jeans to task here.
And who is the final pick, Andy?
Oh, I'm sorry. Brad Pitt as Lawrence Jameson, which, you know...
That's not bad.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Better than Dane Cook.
Yes.
Paul, we do love you, and we do love our fans, and we only josh because we love. So, but seriously, though.
Seriously, Dane. Dane Cook. Come on.
All right. So, thank you for the feedback. If you want to hit us up on Facebook, you can do so at username MathIsHardNet. And now on Twitter, we are at RemakersMark. So, we paid several thousands of dollars to get that, which was probably not well spent, but we're happy to have done so. That is not true.
My kids don't need to go to college.
That's right. Exactly. So now moving on to a quick summary of our picks from last time and who the big winners were. So in the major roles, in the role of Janet Colgate, originally played by Glenn Headley, we went with Lee's choice of Melissa Benoist, I'm not sure which. Great pick, Lee. Benoist. Well done.
Yay.
Good job. Yep, indeed. In the role of Lawrence Jameson, originally played by Michael Caine, we went with Andy and Jair's mutual pick of Colin Firth. Yay! So good job, gentlemen. Well done. And in the role of Freddie Benson, originally played by Steve Martin, we went with my choice of Paul Rudd.
Yay! Yay!
Oh, thanks for the yay, guys. The mercy yay. And then in the minor characters, we went with... let's see here. Oh, Mark's choice of Melora Hardin. In the role of Fanny Eubanks, originally played by Barbara Harris. So, good job, everybody. That was fun.
Everybody won.
Everybody won. We're all the big winners here. So, for the next movie, it is my pick, alphabetically.
I'm excited.
And so, I know, me too. So, I had two picks that could not be more different in mind. And I think I'm going to go with the first one, again, alphabetically. It is an alliterative title, two words, starts with B, and that is The Blues Brothers. The more I thought about that movie, the more I realized how weird of a movie that is. I mean, it's just such a strange movie in so many ways, and we can talk through this specifically in the pre-production, but I would like to have the major roles just be the brothers, right? So just the Aykroyd and Belushi, and then the minor roles be all musicians and performers that we would like to see in there. And again, as I think Andy is typing on the scene here, Carrie Fisher, RIP, Carrie.
That was a good
memory as well. Oh, yeah. Lee, thank you.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just such a strange, unique, weird movie that I think we could have a lot of fun remaking, and it could be a tough one, that's for sure. I know there's a little bit of a blasphemy to that, but I'm down. I think we'll be good for it.
All right.
So yeah,
I don't know if I'm in a different timeline, but I swear that we've done this one already.
You are in a different timeline.
In a different timeline.
Okay.
What
haven't done this
happened
one
to me? Where okay. did I go? Whew.
We might have talked about it like on a special episode or something.
Yeah. I thought maybe I had a tease in there. That was really sweet.
Just kidding, Paul. I know.
The role of Elwood Blues, I choose Dane Cook.
I choose Jim Belushi.
So that should be. Oh God, no!
Jim Belushi.
This is the darkest timeline.
Whoever picks Jim Belushi is banned from the podcast.
Seriously, penalty box forever.
Yep.
All right, so now we move on to the plot, tech, and filmmaking changes that we would like to discuss for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. So going back to that film here. The first of those is that, take this as you will, but we call this a rare adult film. So normally that has a different meaning than what
worst
we refer to
adult
that.
Film so, ever.
Exactly. Michael Caine. And it's a comedy. At that. So it's not a dumb comedy, I think is what we're saying, is that it's a very intelligent, very well-written comedy. Jerry, you're the one that kind of started that discussion in our little write-up here. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, I feel like we're kind of getting into this point in movie making where we're starting to see a little bit of a resurgence of this style of comedy. The past decade has seemed to be really skewing towards kind of the raunchy comedy, wherever that started. But those kinds of sort of gross out, let's see how far we can push.
Hello?
Hello?
Chair? Yep, Lee, I can hear. There you are. Hello? Okay. Hello? You're back.
Yeah, you cut out for a while.
Oh, I might have. Did I bump my mute button?
Maybe.
Okay.
Start at raunchy comedies.
Let me start over, because I don't remember what I was saying. I feel like we are in this period of filmmaking where we're starting to see more comedies like this come back. For the past decade or so, it has been a lot of erring on the side of raunchy comedy, where it's kind of, let's see how much we can push the envelope in our gags and how kind of the gross out jokes and what sort of topics we can cover. And it's just, it's getting to the point where it's played out. It's not funny. It's not well written. It's just, let's just see how gross we can be and laugh. There's a lot of that, or there's comedies that are almost not even comedies. They're just very, very uptight. And the jokes are all in what the topic is, and not so much in how it's presented and the performances. And then I guess the third one is more of this sort of absurd comedy. Your Will Ferrell and his director friend that I can't remember his name of right now. But that
Adam
that
McKay
whole idea of,
is that right?
Adam McKay. Yep. Yeah, you're right. Like the stepbrothers and the Anchormans of the world, where it's just like it's funny because it's just so weird and absurd and bizarre. Like, which is fine. I liked Anchorman. I like Step Brothers. I think they're both pretty funny movies. But I want more comedies like this one. I want a comedy that is sharply written, that relies a lot on the performers themselves, reading good dialogue and acting in a comedic way, like people like Steve Martin could do, like no other. And even I think we had a similar conversation with the Three Amigos in that it was this great ensemble cast of comedians all doing what they do really, really well. I think Ghostbusters tried to do that, and I just think it missed the remake. It tried to come back to that kind of comedy, and in some ways it did. There were some really funny jokes in there, and I think Chris Hemsworth and his character was really well written and really funny, and he just did a good job. But I just want more of this. I want more quotable, funny movies that are going to stand up and still be a funny movie 20 years from
now. I would posit that the Ocean's 11 remake is along that line on a slightly different tack. That it's not a comedy per se. I think
it's almost an action.
It's a caper. There are definitely comedic elements, but it's a movie where there is really good dialogue, a really good ensemble that doesn't have to rely on fart jokes and fall down, go boom humor, which don't get me wrong. I love that. But, this was when you were talking about the elements that you were looking for, this is the movie that popped in my head first.
Interesting.
And it's not like this movie is super sophisticated, although the characters, Michael Caine especially, plays a sophisticated role. It's not a sophisticated comedy. I mean, Root Prick the Monkey Boy is a perfect example. This is a goofy comedy sometimes, but it doesn't rely on that. It doesn't keep falling back into that joke. That did that joke, it was funny, and then they moved on, and they went past it, and they went to something else. And like the wheelchair falling, like going down the stairs to the ocean, like that was a quick little one joke, and it was done. And then it went back to this great interplay between Janet and Freddie and Lawrence and Janet. Like it was all how the characters interacted with each other, and it didn't rely on sight gags or any of that kind of stuff.
It's interesting. One that comes to mind with sort of a modern and the tone is different, I guess. But to me, Wes Anderson movies feel kind of like a modern day interpretation of that, where it's in what happens, not how it happens. Although the way he films it is hard.
I don't know about that one. I was thinking exactly that. And although I'm a stronger supporter of that notion, but, the key in those in Wes Anderson's projects is it really is in, you know, the dialogue and the characters, and yeah, there is they are obviously comedies, they are meant to be that, but there's that same sort of intelligence that underlies all of the jokes. They're just a little bit more atmospheric than Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. But yeah, I think that Wes Anderson gets the closest to Dirty Rotten Scoundrels than we've seen in the modern era.
Yeah.
Just because of the intelligence.
Yeah, it's very well written that happens to also be impeccably filmed. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a fine film, but it's not an impeccably filmed film. Like, you don't notice it because of the filming. Whereas I think people can view Wes Anderson films either as art filmed or dialogue performed, you know, and it's not like there's Ne'er the Twain Shall Meet, right? I mean, it's both of those things, but you can pick apart a Wes Anderson scene visually as much as you can from a dialogue perspective. And I don't think you would necessarily say that about this movie.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels just benefited from a really beautiful setting.
Yes. Yeah. But it didn't really try very much in terms of filmmaking. It didn't need to. It relied on the writing and the acting.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think the closest analogy to me, and this isn't today, but one that I was thinking of that hits very similarly in about the same time frame, I think, is A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh, yeah.
That's another one where it was just like really quirky and weird with amazing performances and amazing performers and still a lot of weirdness, right? Still a lot of bizarre stuff in there, Kevin Klein. So that one was one that like is another example of that time that hit kind of all the same marks that that Dirty Rotten Scoundrel did. That was an adult movie that was a comedy and was funny because of the writing and the performances.
It came out in the same year.
Oh, nice. I couldn't remember. I thought maybe Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was a little before, but cool. Right on.
Yeah, that's a good call. We could probably throw a clue in here as well.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah, and that era of comedy writing in movies, there was so much more of this style of movie, and I miss it. I watched The Burbs yesterday because I love that movie, and it was the same thing. Like, this is a bunch of people playing off of each other with smart dialogue and just great performances, individual performances. And I never thought that there was a joke that was too dumb or that there it still holds up, and it's 20 years old, and I want a movie that I'm going to want to see 20 years from now and quote with my friends.
I feel like nowadays, I think there are those types of movies, but I think they've replaced a percentage of the funny with novel. And oftentimes that novel could be called weird as well. I'm thinking of something like, oh God, what was the movie with Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, The Cabin, crap, I'll look it up. Or Safety Not Guaranteed. Did you guys see that one? That was another good one.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, it's funny and it's adult, but it's weird, right? I mean, and I wouldn't put that at the same level quite as Dirty Rotten Scoundrel, certainly. But, oh, the one I love is the one I was referring to. So they take like some of that funniness and just like tweak it a little bit just to make it more novel and a little bit weird.
Did you guys see, came out last year, The Nice Guys?
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm.
That to me is one of the better comedies that has come out in recent years. It's not like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It's more like, what was the De Niro one that we did?
Taxi Driver?
Midnight Run?
6-8, yep, at Midnight Run. It's Midnight Run.
Oh, right.
Than it is Planes, Trains, it's more like Midnight Run than it is
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels,
but it's really funny and it's really well written and it's an action comedy and it's a buddy comedy, but it's closer to what I'm looking for. It's just super tight dialogue and just really funny performances by both Russell Crowe and
Ryan Gosling.
Oh yeah, that one. Okay, got it. Yeah, I just couldn't picture it in my head. Got it.
Takes place in the 70s. Yeah, it's really good.
Cool. Yeah. And Jerry, you had a point in here saying, would a remake become too serious? And you said, please no. And I'm in agreement. We talked about that a little bit, but man, like what makes this movie so great is given Steve Martin the range to do what he does in this movie. And Michael Caine is great because he's a foil to him. He puts on a very funny performance too, but anything with the Rupricht, all of those scenes. I mean, it's just so incredibly funny. That to me is like where the most entertaining part of the movie is, and the rest of it is great around it. But that, like, that little core right there is what makes it such an amazing movie that I think keeps us coming back. Moving on just a little bit here. So kind of talking about that, the difference between Michael Caine and Steve Martin, you know, these are very different performances. Andy, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mentioned in the first episode a little bit that Michael Caine, at least to me, does not, I don't think of him as a comedic actor. I think he's a great actor, but I wouldn't picture him initially as a comedic actor. Where Steve Martin, I think for a lot of us, that's his natural genre, if you will. So on paper, I said that the pairing of these two didn't seem like it would work, or at least be nearly as funny as it was. But we are now nearly 30 years later that this movie came out, and still talking about how funny it is. And while, yes, Michael Caine definitely played the straight man for the majority of the movie, he still, you could tell, especially when he was playing Dr. Schaffhausen, he had a lot of fun with the role. So I just, I guess, wanted to just bring that point up and talk about the juxtaposition of those two and how it turned out to be such a good comedic team.
I think that's one of the things that makes this work is that it's not two comedians trying to outfunny each
that
other.
That could be it.
A comedian. It's a comedian and a really, really great actor, just doing a great job doing what they do and playing off each other and acting. I was thinking about it, and if you played this movie and just muted it, you wouldn't know it was a comedy for almost 90% of it.
True. I mean, some of the,
yeah, the middle of it would play a little bit different.
The Ruprecht scenes you would pick up on.
Yeah. But I mean, for the most part, it's you know, like you guys said, takes place in this really fancy setting, and it's them going after this girl. It could just as easily be a drama love story, or, you know, just a straight drama than comedy.
Yeah. I think the best thing about this is that Michael Caine makes Steve Martin great and vice versa. You know, I mean, yeah. I think if you had a funnier person, and again, not calling Michael Caine not funny because he plays it perfectly, but if you had a funnier person playing the straight man, it wouldn't play as well. And if you had a straighter person playing the funny man, it wouldn't play as well. And so I think the poles of that allowed it to play the way that it did. And it really strengthened the characters too, because then you can say, like, when you're describing that character, that's how we got to Colin Firth for the Michael Caine role, right? Because it's stoic, British, upright, right? Mm-hmm. And then for the Steve Martin one, it's kind of fluid and, you know, just, you know, willing to do anything, goofy. So it's just very, you know, very well portrayed, well written roles that succeeded because they were so different.
Yeah, and I would give Michael Caine a lot of credit for, well, for not trying to be as silly as Steve Martin. I mean, he clearly is keyed in on what's funny about the movie, and did his part perfectly. He knew that Steve Martin was there to be Ruprecht, and he was there to be sophisticated, and even level, and that's why it was funny. So just him being calm and quiet, and just flashing that well placed smile with perfect timing, it makes it so perfect.
They definitely had their own roles very clearly defined, but that was the nature of the characters. And that's what I think. I agree that is one of the things that made it work so well.
One of the people that was initially going to play Lawrence Jameson, and he turned it down, I believe, to play in A Fish Called Wanda, was John Cleese.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And another outstanding little tidbit is that it was originally written, the whole script for this remake was originally written for Mick Jagger and David Bowie.
Oh, what?
What? Wow.
Who playing?
Imagine
so,
that.
Okay, wow. So I'm going to assume, perhaps incorrectly,
David Bowie,
yes,
Lawrence Jameson,
and then Mick Jagger probably is Freddie Benson.
Yeah. I could see that. My wow. God, I could
blow,
see that.
Blow your mind.
The two skinniest con men ever.
Yeah. We should do a mashup of the Dancing in the Streets video with dialogue from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh, that's so good.
It's just meant to happen.
Maybe that video was meant to be like the trailer for the movie that never was.
Yeah. It was a proof of concept, and it went terrible.
The producers are like, scrap the project.
After that video, they're like, we're going to go a different direction, David and Mick.
Are they supposed to be hugging this much? This is really weird.
Although I do believe they won an MTV Video Music Award for that.
I believe you're right.
Have you guys seen the videos of that music video without the audio?
Oh, that's so good. Yeah.
It's so funny.
We'll link to that in the show notes. It is fantastic.
Oh, man.
Well, the third thing we're talking about here is the fact that this is indeed a con movie. So, Mark, you touched on this fact. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the con aspect of this was? And you had kind of a historical piece as well, right?
Yeah. So the scam in this movie, well, I was going to pose this as like a big surprise that this is something that actually happened. But I guess it shouldn't be that surprising that, yes, con men are actual people. Men and women. Scams do exist, but I think this particular scam is beautiful that we can say this actually happened. There was this guy who came to be known as the Swiss Gigolo. And yes, because he was Swiss. Oh, still is Swiss. This happened very, very recently, actually. And because he had a lot of sex.
Oh, you mean coitus?
Yes, coitus, the physical act of love.
Gotcha.
Yeah, his con was basically the same thing. He targeted older, wealthy women and would wine and dine them. And then once they were actually in a physical romantic relationship, he would drop this story about having hit a young girl with his car while driving in America. In some versions of the story, the girl was actually the daughter of a mafia boss. But for one reason or another, he needed a bunch of money. And, oh, hey, these women actually happened to have a bunch of money. So he ended up receiving a lot of that money. He sort of met his match when he tried to up his game and targeted a German billionaire heiress. And she also fell for it and gave him like $9 million. But then when he asked for more, she rejected him. But that's when he revealed that he had videotapes of them. So yeah, he blackmailed her for another like $50 million. And that's when she turned him into the cops. This was in like 2007.
Wow. That's amazing.
But yeah, this guy made millions and millions of dollars running this con. Yeah, paying romantic attention to older women and then telling them a sob story.
Have you guys ever watched The White Rabbit Project on Netflix?
No, not yet. We're going to. We haven't got.
That's where I heard about this guy.
Yeah, that's where I heard about it too. And it's like there's one episode that's dedicated where the theme of the episode is cons. So they all talk about a different con that actually happened, and this was one of them. But that's actually a good episode to watch. You guys should check it out.
Yeah, totally. That's just for background. That's everybody except for Jamie and Adam from MythBusters. So it's Tori. Carrie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they're doing similar. I mean, it's not like MythBusters Lite or whatever. It's a little bit different, but same kind of idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. The idea is that they go down the rabbit hole on a particular topic.
Yep.
And they sort of compete with each other for stories or examples or projects or whatever.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting story that they covered in. Among others, but yeah, I thought that was kind of incredible that he was actually be able to bilk that much money out of one person. That blew my mind.
That'll teach you kids. Just be cool with $9 million.
Yeah, don't get greedy.
One of the things that floored me was that this guy wasn't a player until he decided to be. He wasn't a particularly handsome man. He's just kind of sort of average. He just started running cons because he just decided to. He was a Swiss investment banker who just decided to break bad. And he broke really bad.
No kidding.
Not quite cooking meth bad, but bad.
Bad enough.
Yeah,
bad made, enough. Made a lot more money.
Fair. So we touched on it a little bit in the first part and a little bit in this part, too. But there are some other references and other kind of options for this movie. So, Jared, do you want to talk about the kind of twist at the end? That was one thing that I had a brief qualm with. But why don't you start us off here about your thoughts on that?
Sure. Spoiler alert. I think we probably should have said that a little a while back. But so the end of the movie, the Mark turns out to have been conning the two main characters the whole time, and tables turn, whoa, and she gets away with their money and then comes back and lets them join in on her next con, and now it's three con artists all teamed up in some sort of giant con Voltron. Vol-con.
And I will.
We've got our title, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, boy. Yes, I like the fact that the whole tables got turned and it was her playing them the whole time. Something like that should happen in the movie, but I don't think that it should play out the exact same way. Number one, because everybody's going to see it coming, or at least everybody who loves this movie is going to see it coming. And number two, the very, very end where she comes back in, turns Michael Caine into an Australian and Steve Martin into a mute. That part felt tagged on, and I wasn't a super big fan of it. So I think there should be some sort of twist, but maybe not a step-for-step twist like there was before. What do you guys think?
Huh. And, you know, until you just said that, I never thought of that scene as tagged on, but it is a little bit tagged on.
The movie could have ended.
It could have ended at the airport. You're right. It is a nice little putting a bow on the package and wrapping things up. I don't know. I'm kind of a fan of the idea of having the original cast as the in the ensemble of Greek tourists coming back in the end. But anyway, I see your point though. That would there be another way of wrapping it up? Because ending it at the airport almost seems too abrupt. But putting some sort of scene, perhaps they're, you know, the way that last scene starts is that Lawrence Jameson and Freddie Benson are saying goodbye to each other as Lawrence Jameson is eating his breakfast overlooking the ocean, that maybe they could get some news of the Jackal, you know, on some other you know, some new heist or something like that. So they get some news of the con continuing somewhere else. I don't know, just kind of some other way of wrapping it up without being quite so neat and tidy.
I have an idea. So instead of ending at the airport, you just... Okay, so we assume that they both know that she's conned them. But at some point, you know, toward the very end of the movie, it's somehow revealed that Jameson actually conned both of them, and therefore he won the bet or whatever. So like there's another depth to it, I guess, to the twist.
I was thinking about that too, like having sort of that double nobody knows what's going on anymore kind of thing that movies are doing sometimes, where okay, no, he did actually know that she was the Jackal, and so he went even farther into another realm, and then but then all three of them got conned by the butler. And, like, you know,
it was Emperor Palpatine the whole time.
Yeah. It was old Michael Caine. But movies are doing that now. Now they layer and layer and layer. It's like you stop caring about what actually happened by the end. But no, I think something like that where, you know, somebody else figures out, and then there's this third layer beyond the, you know, this secondary twist or whatever.
Can we call it conception?
Wow. Con puns all the way down.
Conception.
We started with Con Air and we're ending with Conception.
Oh, man.
But no, I like that idea. I like this. I like pulling another one, another. Maybe a good one is, I'm trying to think of a good example. Italian Job, maybe.
Yeah.
Where it's like everybody's duping everybody. Huh. And by the end, you don't even know what actually happened or who actually won.
I don't like that idea. I don't like how they're usually executed.
And that's what I'm saying. I don't want it to get to that point, but I do like adding on this layer of, but he did know that she was conning him, and so he was conning her back. As long as we don't just keep on doing that over and over again, and then, oh no, but Steve Martin knew that he knew that she knew, and then the police chief Wiggum knew that they knew that he knew that they knew. Like, then it gets ridiculous, and then we're back to.
I don't think that the problem lies in execution. I think that the spirit of this film is that we spend 90 or whatever minutes with Lawrence and Freddie competing to be the best con person, and it turns out that it's neither of them. It's this competition of egos, and they both lose, and that's the point, really. I think the ending doesn't need to change because they both learn their lesson, and the denouement and in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, it kind of lets that breathe for a little bit, but then adds a little bit of heartwarming. I think that a remake could stay exactly the same.
Perhaps it would be, I like what you're saying, Mark, perhaps it would be less of a Hallmark moment for her to suddenly like join forces with them, and instead may it be a little more of a kick them while they're down moment of her coming back, maybe in that role of this fake real estate agent or whatever she's pretending to be, and then kind of essentially claiming her title and making the two of them leave town.
I don't know if I'd call the formation of a crime super syndicate a Hallmark moment, but but it is nice for them to all respect each other and be friends.
Agree to disagree.
What if it was flipped and the ending was not her coming back to them, but them finding her and essentially adopting them in, creating this trio that way? No, I don't like that either. Never mind.
It just sets up dirtier, rottener scoundrels.
What if Arthur reveals himself as Emperor Palpatine, and then
force lightnings them all to death?
Force lightnings them all into becoming the new Sith apprentices.
Con limited power.
Yeah, but only two there are.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy. This is deteriorating rapidly, as our second episodes often do.
The Greek tourists show up and you just hear him execute order 6.
Unlimited power.
Lordy.
I do like at the airport when they realize that they've been conned, how true to character they both react to that.
Yeah.
Where Freddie Benson, Steve Martin, just freaks out and gets angry and throws his stuff and does a little Steve Martin tantrum. And Michael Caine
just smiles.
Like,
and laughs.
He knows he's been bested. And he accepts it. He accepts that he's been bested, and laughs about it. Presumably, also because he's a millionaire and $50,000 is nothing.
Yeah,
But yeah, I feel like it could have ended there and just been just as good.
Agree.
The only thing that bothered me about this movie is how fast it went from them sort of giving up the con to her conning them. I don't want to take anything away from the first part of the movie because I like all the building that goes into that, but I feel like it just went too quickly to them being conned. Did you guys feel that way at all, or did the pacing feel okay to you?
I think it needed to spend more time with their cons.
Yeah.
And the because them getting conned really is the twist, and it needs to happen pretty suddenly. Now, I think the logic behind the and the arguments behind convincing, conning, those need to be smooth. But but as an audience, we shouldn't have that much time to predict it.
And I thought it did go, it did flow pretty smoothly from them trying to get the money to her explaining to Lawrence Jameson that she's really not rich, that she's trying to get this money and it's kind of bankrupting her, to him saying, the bet's off, we're not doing it. And then they change the bet to, instead of getting money, to Steve Martin has to sleep with her. And that kind of like, then that starts happening. And, but at that point you're already like, something's going on. And then it really moves rapidly from there. But I feel like they did a good job transitioning slowly to the point where things were changing, things were happening. You didn't really know what was going on, but you still didn't catch that she was conning them until the very, very end.
Yeah.
Even though she was the one changing the game, she was the one changing the rules that whole third act.
I do appreciate that they didn't like Kaiser Sose it, you know, and then have that moment of like realization. I mean, I guess they did on the tarmac there, like you said, but they didn't, you know, they didn't have voiceover saying like, it was her all along. You know what I mean? Like that would have been terrible, but I don't know. Maybe I'm pulling back on this a little bit. I feel like it could have had just a little bit more time with that. Like it just happened to happen so quickly, but maybe it happens at the speed that they feel it happened.
I got it.
Lawrence
I got
and
it.
Freddie feel.
I got
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Go Andy.
We see a moment. We're going to do a Usual Suspects moment. We see Janet Colgate walking away and getting into a car driven by Lady Fanny of Omaha.
I thought you were going to say Pete Postlethwaite, and I was like,
he's dead.
Let's just CGI him.
Lady Fanny is in on the gag. That makes perfect sense now.
There you go.
Boom. Huge explosion, directed by Michael Bay.
And they both transform into airplanes and fly away.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
I love this remake. I love it.
I want to change my butler pick to Nicolas Cage.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
I want to change my Lady Fanny pick to, Nicolas Mark Cage. Wahlberg.
Wow. With Megan Fox as Lady Fanny. All right. Well, let's wrap it up, gentlemen. I think we've had enough this
evening. We probably should.
Indeed. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Google Play and iTunes, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. We are on both Facebook, search for Math is Hardnet, and Twitter, at Remakers Mark, so please join in on the discussion there, too. So, gentlemen, until the next time we meet for Blues Brothers, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.